except Mrs. Margaret Thomas Murray. She came to Alaska in 1911, and she has a very distinguished husband, a Dr. Claus Murray of Moose, Wyoming. He came to Alaska in 1920, and he's been working for the Biological Survey for 25 years. That's known as the Fish and Wildlife Service. I believe tonight we're going to, I think you're going to start, Chris, Mrs. Murray.
You want me to?
Yes.
We came to Alaska in the fall of 1911. I was a small girl with eyes and ears wide open, and I realize now after many years that a small girl can hear and see quite a bit. Those days are still very vivid in my memory. We came to Dawson and caught the last boat downriver from Dawson to Panama. And I think the whole trip took about 2 weeks from Seattle to Fairbanks. But that fall of 1911 was a very beautiful fall in the Tanana Valley. The birch leaves were all gold, and I remember a wonderful horse and buggy picnic trip we went on with the McCauley family out to the Tanana. Mrs. McCauley drove the buggy and the horse, and a whole group of women went out there for a picnic, and that was the 29th of September, which is a pretty late date for a picnic in Alaska, I think. But then came winter, and that was my mother's first experience of living, other than in a large town or a city, living under the conditions, winter conditions that prevailed in Fairbanks of those days. We lived in a little four-room log cabin at 8th and Bonnefield, which was the last cabin, the last house on the last street in Fairbanks at that time. At the end, the street ended in an oat field, which belonged to Mr. Pinkerton, I think his name was. And beyond the oat field was just the slough, little slough and ponds and woods clear to the river, with a tall fringe of spruce trees along the river. I remember that first winter going to school at 8:30 in the morning with a faint, bright gold sky of sunrise on the way to school, and coming back in darkness at 3 o'clock. But it was never pitch dark here, as you all remember. The snow, the moon, and the stars made a difference. One little thing I remember is how straight the smoke stood up in the, from the stovepipes those winter mornings when it was real cold. That was a sign of real cold weather. Another little funny thing I remember is the wooden sidewalks, how crunchy the footsteps sounded on those sidewalks when they had snow packed on them in the winter. If you were having a visitor, you could hear him coming down the street quite a while before he arrived at the house. You knew, here he comes. I remember, it seems to me in looking back, that the women who came to Fairbanks in those days made a special effort to create a little world like the little worlds they had left out in the States, and perhaps for that reason made extra efforts to have a little more formality. The ladies went calling on each other and left calling cards. I remember how interested I was in looking on the little tray that stood on a little table by the front door, even in that little log house, to see the full names of these ladies who had come to call on my mother that afternoon. There was an organization called the Arctic Brotherhood. I don't know whether that still exists, but they had the very formal, fancy parties in the wintertime. And the next day in the Fairbanks, I suppose it was News Miner even then, there were descriptions of all the gowns that all the ladies wore. And I remember my stepfather, Mr. Gillette, reading those accounts out loud and laughing over how many ladies had crepe de chine dresses. That crepe de chine seemed to stick in his mind somehow. The first outstanding thing I remember which happened in a winter up here was one of the winters not long after we came, and some of you people here can tell me exactly what year it was, but it was the news of the Alaska Railroad Bill having passed Congress. As I recall, that happened in the wintertime. The telegram came, the railroad bill had passed Congress. Mother and I were home in the little house, and suddenly we heard the fire whistle, and then we heard the 6 o'clock whistle at the NC, and then we heard the Alaska laundry whistle, and then all the dogs that were down at the dog pound behind the slaughter, on the slaughterhouse, which was right down here somewhere, howling, and then the telephone rang, and it was Daddy saying that the railroad bill had passed. Now, everybody flocked out onto the streets in great excitement, and we had an impromptu parade. And the thing I remember about that parade is that some soul here had found a coal scuttle, probably the only coal scuttle in Alaska at the time, and he was sort of the feature of that parade, carrying the coal bucket, because the railroad bill having passed meant the opening up of the coal mines, the coal reserve deposits, and at that time people thought that would mean a great deal to the development of Alaska. As I recall, the coal mines being opened up almost as important as the railroad itself. So as I look back on those days, I remember even then a feeling of our being isolated and far away from the rest of the world, a sort of the universe and landed way up here in the Arctic, but still spinning with its own little independent life. And because of that, perhaps more independent and yet more intimate, more interdependent among each other. But the simple pleasures we had were so keenly enjoyed. Another wonderful thing for us school children was the arrival once a week, I believe. Now, Bobby Sheldon knows more about this, but there was the arrival of the 6-horse mail sleigh from Valdez that came in once a week over the trail, our only communication with the outside world, which brought the first class mail and maybe a few very special packages and maybe a few very special eggs, which probably were frozen before they got here, and a few special oranges and apples and passengers. There was one driver, and if someone here can give me his correct name, I'd appreciate it. His last name was Martin, I think.
Harry.
Oh, thank you. He was a very dashing character to us school children, and when the day that he was driving, we were all out there after school, we'd rush to the corner of 8th and Cushman to watch and listen and wait for that mail sleigh. Pretty soon we'd hear the bells on the horses, and someone would shout, "Here he comes," and this big sleigh of the horses would come dashing down Cushman Street, and Harry would be in this wonderful coonskin coat and the Martin fur cap with the tails flying out behind and cracking his whip at the horses and all the kids yelling, "Hi, Harry," and "Hi, kids." That was a great event. That was the connection with the outside world. And it was also a great event for us just to see that team, because the horses always raced down Cushman. They knew they were getting to the end of the trail. Well, finally, spring came, and where we lived on 8th and Bonnefield, Daddy had built a picket fence across the front of our place, and that picket fence, the two before behind the pickets, was a good place to climb up on and stand and watch on those spring evenings to see who would be the first one to see the little white plume of smoke down here above the treetops that meant that the first boat of the season was coming. And that was the greatest event of all, the first steamer. We'd be hearing from the Signal Corps. As I remember, they had little bulletins posted out on the doorway of the Signal Corps office. Steamer Swatka downriver at Dawson at 8 a.m. May the 30th or whatever it was. And then the next day we'd watch the progress on those bulletins. And finally we'd know it was almost time for that steamer to be getting up to Fairbanks, and we'd be watching. And child who first saw that plume of smoke was a real hero or heroine, and we'd rush in to tell everybody. Pretty soon we'd hear the dogs begin to howl down here because they heard the steamer too. And then the whole town was at the waterfront to watch the arrival of the first boat, of course. Everybody happy, except perhaps those coming back from outside who might see Waterfront Brown standing there at the foot of the gangplank. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but my recollection is that he was the character who was a self-appointed Humane Society, and he was also a bill collector, and he was always on the waterfront to meet the returning boats and to pick up somebody who owed somebody some money and who hadn't paid it before they went. Sometimes you'd see these poor characters sort of being escorted away from the gangplank by Waterfront Brown. I remember he wore a brown derby hat and was always dressed in strictly business clothes with a high white collar. Now, these are the little things that a 9-year-old child remembers, notices and remembers. Later on, I remember that when we began to have the first few tourists who came in the summer all that long way, the Women's Civic Club, I think, or the Pioneer Women, used to gather bouquets from their gardens, because even then people had beautiful gardens. And there were bouquets put in the hotel rooms for all the tourist ladies, I remember. One of the first buildings I remember where we stayed when we first arrived was the old Shaw House. And that was also sort of a center of culture in the town, as I recall, because Mrs. Shaw served wonderful meals, and it was a custom of the quote, leading families of the town to go to the Shaw House for Sunday dinner sometimes. And that stood, I think, at 2nd and Wickersham. And later on, there were tennis courts built there at 1st and Wickersham on the block in front of the hotel. And that was one of the occupations of summer evenings. People were playing tennis on the tennis courts. And the children were running all over town, as they still do probably, on their bicycles and afoot, watching the tennis games and seeing whatever else was going on, and being told it was time they should go to bed, but not wanting to go to bed. I don't know whether children ever go to bed in Alaska in the summer. And then as spring advanced, there were picnics down at Leah Bar. Now, I suppose Leah Bar isn't very far from where we're sitting right now. I'm so confused by all the developments in Fairbanks, I don't recognize old places anymore. But the early day picnics had to always be out on the river bars, because that was the only place you had any relief from mosquitoes. And the mosquitoes were another reason why most of the houses in Fairbanks had screen porches, and people had beautiful hanging baskets of flowers hanging inside the screen porches. You almost lived in those screen porches. And so they needed to be decorated with a little plant life. And people went visiting up and down the streets and sat on the screen porches with their neighbors and visited. I think there was a lot of just plain visiting that went on in those early days that probably doesn't go on so much now, because people are all on wheels. I remember that sometimes during the winter, ladies would come to, as they call it, spend the day. I don't know whether anybody goes to their neighbors to spend the day anymore, but there was a custom then. You brought your sewing basket and came and spent the day, and it was just lovely. You did plenty of visiting. Well, then, of course, I can't pass over summer without mentioning berry picking, but then you probably all remember about how important berry picking was. In the spring of 1918, May 4th, 1918, at midnight, I left home to go away on my first adventure, and that was the last trip of the old NC stage line out over the trail. The last trip of the mail stage, the last trip for passengers. The breakup was coming, and the NC company was going out of business as far as the stage line was concerned, because the government railroad was being built, and they expected to have transportation between ends of steel by fall that time. That trip was a long story, and I'm not going to tell it here, but I just mention that we had to travel at night. We had to cross 5 rivers south of Fairbanks before we could stop at all, because the rivers were all about to go out, and we were getting across on the ice with these 4 horses attached to a double-ender sleigh. And it took 9 days to get to Chittenden. And this evening in the News Miner, I read about this Yukon Marathon that's going to take place, where they're going to come from Circle on the Yukon, down the Yukon to Tananaw, and up the Tananaw, and up the Chena in 24 hours. Well, makes me feel I belong in another age, probably. But I think before I stop talking, I just want to mention that I like to think of the simple elements that made up our lives in those days. I think in a way people, for whatever motives they had in coming to Alaska, were rather proud to be far away and making their own lives, rather proud to be pioneers and to learn how to both cope with their land and to enjoy the gifts it had to give of freedom and sun and air and wildlife and the mighty forces of nature, the cold and the dark of the winter and the bugs in the summer, the dangerous rivers. It was all Alaska, and anyone who ever knows Alaska never quite gets Alaska out of their system, I think. Thank you very much.
Well, I don't know what to say, but after all that, to this reminiscing society, as I think of history, it's a very important thing. As we have a chance to look back over history, as we do in Alaska, we can, if we look at it intelligently, not only a little long for the old times, but we have an opportunity to improve on mistakes we've made, and also to hang on to the good things of the old days. I mean, when I was in the hospital a while ago, I read a book called The Uses of the Past, and I've often thought of that. Now, try as I can't push my time back in Alaska beyond 1920. That's the first time I came to Alaska. The old biological survey, E.W. Nelson, who had been in Alaska, was chief. He'd been in Alaska in 1877 to 81. And he'd been down on the Bering Sea area. And he was chief, and he wanted someone to come up here to Alaska to study the caribou. And I was just recently out of college, and I was for adventure, and he sent me up here, and I just wanted to go over the country. Well, in the years that followed 1920, that was before the days of cars and airplanes. In the winter time, we traveled with a dog team, the only way to get around anywhere. In the summer, you just walked. It isn't a canoe country, necessarily. And I walked in the summer back in the between here and Circle and different places. Packed the dogs like the Indians did, who packed on the back. In the winter time, I used a dog team. And all my territory was all interior and northern Alaska. That's a sizable area, and I covered a great deal of that with dog team. Now, they talk about the frozen north, the hardships, and all that. I remember when my brother and I were up in the Brooks Range, they called it the Endicott Range then, and we had the 50, 60, 70 below zero for a short time. We didn't travel those days. And we stayed in our tent. That sounds terrible if you write it up in a story for these magazines. But we didn't think too much of it. I mean, it was we felt the cold as anyone would. But there were good days too. We figured that 20 degrees below zero was good hiking weather. You could run behind the dog sled and get along fine at 20 below zero. And my brother and I had a rule that if we could hear our breath, you know, in cold weather, when it's really cold, your breath as it goes by your ear has a faint hissing sound. The little particles of moisture are freezing. If we could hear that, we didn't have a thermometer. We knew it was 50 below zero or more, and we didn't go anywhere because we heard the old tales about being out in cold weather and frosting your lungs and all that. And some of the dogs had that trouble too. But if we didn't hear that, we'd travel. Well, I remember Marty spoke about a waterfront brown here. I came in off one trip in the spring of the year, and I had some of the young dogs, I don't know where I was living then, out here somewhere in the cabin. I can't find the place now. These dogs were young. That is, they could pull a sled, but they were young dogs, you know, and they liked to play. And I had them tied up in the yard where I was staying. And one evening I took them out, before all these houses were here, I took them out for a little run, just for exercise. And they jumped around, played, and went with me down the street. And then a little child who was just toddling along, I forgot her name now, she saw the dogs and got scared and started to run. And that's the worst thing you can do for any animal, is to run. The impulse is to chase. And the dogs went after her, and they were still playful, but they put their paws up on her just like they did with me and so on. And she fell down, and they chewed her head a little bit, just in play, you know, but it tore her scalp a little bit. Well, I got down there as fast as I could and got the dogs at home, but I went down and paid the doctor bill for sewing up that scalp. But you know, the people in Fairbanks were all stirred up over that. Some of the people...
Stop you for one second.
Yeah.
He must have turned his roll over.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, the people in the community here were on two sides of that. All the dog people who had dog teams thought the dogs were all right, and other people thought it was wrong and so on. And Waterfront Brown came out there to my house, and he had a pistol, and he was official of the town. And he said, I'll take care of those dogs. And I said, just wait a minute, I'll take care of myself. I said, these are government dogs. And, oh, government. He wondered about that. And I didn't want him to interfere. But the dog who had done the damage to the girl, I thought I'd better get rid of that dog anyway. And Jesse Rust, who used to be working on the NC here, he took me down the river that night, and I got rid of that black dog. The dog wasn't vicious at all, but he happened to bite that girl, and so I thought I'd better get rid of the dog. And I didn't want Waterfront Brown to interfere with Well, something was said about the new government railroad. And I came here in 1920. I was a Cheechonker. I didn't know much about the country. And that fall, I remember, I went out up the Nenana River, the one fork of the Nenana, up in the mountain sheep country. And I was after specimens, of course, for the National Museum. And I wanted some mountain sheep. And I went out with I didn't know much about the country, I didn't know people, but there was an interior, a man of the Department of Interior, the legal branch, I don't know what he called himself now. He was enforcing laws of some kind, and he and a former jailbird, a fellow who had been committed murder and had been in, and he'd done something wrong, and had been in the penitentiary for quite a while, he was loose, and those two chose to go up after Mount Sheep, and they invited me to go along. Well, I didn't know much about people, and I went out, and we met our camp up the Nenana River, and that day I went my own way. I saw one sheep, I didn't get any that day, but I was so excited, the first Alaska Mountain sheep I'd seen, and so I came back to camp, and I found both of them in camp. And they both claimed they had a cold or something, they had to break camp and go back. And I found out pretty soon they were afraid of each other. They were afraid to be out. They both had guns, you know. And they were scared they would use the guns. And they thought they'd go back. And I was so disappointed. I was just getting interested in the wild country, and I had to go back with them. And down at Nenana, what did they call those coal mines there? Healy. At Healy, I met a fellow they called Hobo Bill. I was on my way back to Fairbanks, and he told me, I saw some grizzly bear dens where they'd dug out some dens for hibernation up on the Morris Creek up in what's now McKinley Park. And he said, I'll go up with you. And he picks up a little dog team, a couple of dogs, and we went up there. And I remember we found we met the man up there on Morris Creek up on the hillside. He had his camp there. And he was a market hunter. He was hunting mountain sheep and selling those sheep to the railroad camps down below, between the ends of steel, and selling right along. And he had the sheep hidden, of course, in hills, but he was selling them to these government camps. And I went out one day with the Hobo Bill, and I was after sheep specimens, and there was a conical hill. There wasn't any cover. I couldn't get any closer to the mountain sheep on the top of that hill. So I took a long shot, and it so happened I hit the sheep. And he was amazed that I could shoot so well. It's just an accident, I guess. But anyway, he wondered if I would come out there and shoot sheep for him for market hunting. He knew I was a government man and all that, but that's the feeling that was in the country at the time along that railroad. Well, I could tell a lot, but I made a cache of some of my things. I couldn't take it all back, and I was going to get it later. And that cache, I had to, they sent me, I was fur warden too. They didn't have anybody up here, so they made me fur warden. I didn't know anything about it. But they sent me one of the Colt's 45. Nobody else carried a gun up here. But they sent me one of those revolvers, and I didn't know what to do with it. And so I left it in this cache here, and Hobo Bill swept it. And I had to, later on, I had to get the marshal to get the gun for me. Because that was accredited to me in Washington. I had to count for everything. But you know, well, those are some of the, what did somebody call those fellows? Those are some of the things that I ran up against as a newcomer to Alaska. But the other side, there's another side to it also. I remember when the park was first established, the Mount McKinley National Park, and they still had the ends of steel. The camps were approaching each other. And I remember my chief wanted me to capture some caribou to cross with the reindeer. At that time they had a lot of reindeer on the Bering Sea coast, and they wanted to cross them because the Alaska caribou is much larger than the reindeer. In fact, I'm sure it's the largest of the species around the world. But anyway, I recommended, I think it was Stony Creek. I'm getting a little hazy on some of the localities now, but out in the park there, I thought Stony Creek out in that direction would be a good migration place to capture some of the caribou. But he listened to Harry Carton's and some others that recommended the pass between Savage River and the next river over. There was a trailer all right, the caribou migrated there, but I didn't know how many did. But he made me go up there, and I made a corral out of wire netting and two wings across the valley way up Savage River. The what? Well, we had a crew of people there. Kennedy was the man who had the horses at that time. And he hauled things up. There wasn't a trailer, road, or anything up there. He found his way up there at that time, and way up Savage River, across the bars and stuff. And he hauled the logs and things to build that fence with. And so, anyway, he was very fond of his horses. And I found later that in the mosquito country, when there were horses up here, they used to mix powder, buhack with lard, and smear the horses with the buhack and lard to keep the mosquitoes off. And he took a great care of his horses. I was so amazed later on. He spent all the money that I could pay him for his help. He spent a great deal of that to take care of his horses, and he thought a great deal of his horses there. But I had a crew of people up there. My brother had joined me at that time. That was about 1922, I think. They went up there and we built that corral up there. And in the crew, well, the Loftus brothers were up there, Jewel and Ted Loftus, and several other people, local people, were helping. We had a camp up there, and they helped to build that corral and two wings across the valley. Well, during the summer, we caught several caribou that came migrating down the valley. But the females we turned loose, and we only caught one male caribou in the whole outfit that we could keep that whole season. I was kind of disappointed, but I was following the instructions of my chief back then in Washington. we had that caribou tethered out on a moss area for the summer, for the rest of the season. We learned how to make one of the halters that the Laplanders use for reindeer down at the on the Bering Sea coast, and I used that halter affair on that caribou and had a long rope and tied it to a log. And then later I put them down near Jenny Creek, I think it was, a moss area near there. Then I went into Fairbanks and I went out there later to get them. And there was a bunch of wild caribou near him, and they saw me and ran off, and he saw me and he started to fall on and broke the rope and went with the butt. That was the end of my caribou experiment for that season. But I don't know, it's very interesting to be there in the early days of that national park. I remember Harry Carsons told me a lot of stories about the early days in Alaska, especially when he and Hudson Stuck climbed Mount McKinley, the first one to climb the mountain, and off on the other point, a little bit lower, 300 feet lower, I guess, was the pole that the old pioneers had carried up to the top of that mountain. Had climbed the mountain, they thought they were at the top just as well as anywhere they were at the top, as I see it. And they put that pole up there, carried that pole all the way up there, and had a flag there, and he still saw the pole. And he thought they were wonderful. They were real pioneer climbers. And he spoke with great admiration of those. Well, I remember the first visitor to Mount McKinley National Park. I don't remember now whether Bobby Sheldon here had the horses. She came up with on a horse and had a guide with her. And Harry Carson, he didn't know what to do. Here was a visitor to the National Park. That is something new in his experience, and he didn't know what in the world to do about it. He asked me if I would go along and tell her about the flowers and birds and things. So I went with her, and she was on the horse and the guide, and I was running along like a dog behind the horse. And she was a botanist. She was a very intelligent person, very much interested in the botany of the area, and I told her what I could about what we saw along the way. And that, as I remember now, that was about the first visitor to Mount McKinley National Park. And and I had the job of going along. Harry Carson didn't know what to do about it, so I was camped up there, and he asked me if I would go out with her and tell her about things. Well, I remember when we were still up there, my brother and I were there, the President Harding was in here at the time, and he had the orders, Harry Carson had orders to get mob sheep to ship into Fairbanks for a dinner of some kind in honor of the President. And he didn't know just where they were at that time of year, so he got word up to my brother and me up there at our camp on Savage Fork, and his assistant came up there with a horse, and it was about time to go to bed, but he wondered if we would go out and get a sheep for him. and be down there at the station and in time in the afternoon, about 4 o'clock, I guess, the train went into Fairbanks, and get it in there for sure. Well, we knew that the sheep at that time were pretty much on outside range on the other side from where we were, so we went way down to that savage camp that near that place where Bob Sheldon later on had a station, and we camped there for the night. And we slept about an hour that night, about midnight. And then we went off in the mountains and to hunt sheep. We separated to make sure, and I went up there and I couldn't find any sheep. It was too late anyway, and I went back. And pretty soon I saw my brother coming, and he had a sheep. And we got down there to got it down in time to the headquarters and found that the president had changed his plans and they were already out toward the coast. I don't know who ate that sheep, somebody did. But those are some of the things that, I don't know, I could go on and indefinitely talk about it, but I'll tell you one thing that I'll never forget. Those dog team trips I made back in the hills, in the rainy pass country, I went to the Kuskokwim, down the all those rivers, and up in the Brooks Range, head of the Latina River, and all through the country, I ran across these cabins where old-timers, pioneers lived. And you know, we're all kinds of people, of course, but I found that those people, many of them, were well-read. They had time to read, and they had time to think. And I was amazed at some of the things, some of the thoughts that I ran across among those old-timers, among those pioneers. And they varied, of course, as all people do. But here and there, along the Yukon, different places, I ran across people who could discuss things, and, well, I can't describe it, but I was impressed with what I saw. And what I saw among the Indians and Eskimo, way off, away from the white man, they had a culture that I think we should pay some attention to. They had some elements of their way of thinking, the way of their attitude toward life, and the ability to do things, things that I think we should give some attention to if we can. And that was one of the things that impressed me in those years in Alaska, what I found among the people. I don't mean to say that we're all degenerate or anything, but there's some things in history that I think we should try to hang on to, some of the early things. And, I was so pleased when the pioneers of Alaska finally gave me an honorary membership. I wasn't here in 1898, of course, I couldn't qualify, but they gave me an honorary membership, and I wish I had that button with me now. I value that more than anything that I have, that the pioneers of Alaska would give me that pin. And Jesse Rust of the NC Company, when he learned about that, he was one of them. He came and put that button on my lapel and said, just a bit of friendship. Well, I like to think of the friendship of the pioneer days of Alaska. I like to think of that human intercourse that we had among the best people. And I could talk for a week about adventures here, but
Doctor, may I ask you, some of the characters you knew up there around 1920 to 25, can you give us the names of them and tell us something about them?
The people?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish I could remember the names of a great many people. Now, they were the Yenner brothers on the Yukon River at what they called Purgatory. And those Yenner fellows were wonderful. They could discuss Shakespeare, discuss philosophy. They were artists. They could make carvings. And they were I think they were wonderful. And Frankie Suda, who was living on the Yukon, as a trader there, some of his, some of his children were at the university too. And he was a wonderful person. Oh, I could tell stories about him. And I wish I could remember all of, you know, I've seen thousands of people since then, and I can't remember the names, although I remember the people.
Do you remember some of the tracks that lived around that plantation in the Hill Park area?
Yeah, yes, I got his dog team. Oh, yes. Yes. Well, now that I hear the names, I...
Remember Draghi, the trapper? Andrew Draghi? He was from Slovakia, and lived there, Pavonia, and lived there quite a long time, trapped.
Oh, yes. And Morris Marine, those people. Yes, Hart Perkins and, yes, they were with us, and Billy McCrow with, I wish I could remember, yes. Who?
And Dan Kennedy used to run a pack train out to the creek back in his old.
Oh, yes. He loved horses.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I remember that very well. The Brooklyn Eagle newspaper, they used to go around and dedicate parks all over the country. I suppose they don't do that anymore. But they came, I think it was the year 1922. That's as I recall it. They came to Mount McKinley Park, and they had the little picnic there and a little ceremony and dedicated Mount McKinley National Park. And yes, there were about 40 people.
It's all set.
You know, I wish I could remember more of what was taking place in McKinley National Park from then on, but. I know Harry Carstens was the first superintendent, and then later, I think Mr. Harry Leek, wasn't it, was the superintendent, and there have been several since then, but I was moved away from there by official order, and I went to other parts of Alaska, way up in the Brooks Range, head of the Lapna River, and up the Tanana River to what they call Tana Cross now. They used to call it Tanana Crossing, and over to Eagle, and I went all over Circle and Fort Yukon, all over the country with a dog team. And then in later years, in 1925, I went out to the Alaska Peninsula, what is now known as, well, it was there too, known as Isabeck Bay. And I spent a season there. I got several specimens of the big brown bear of Alaska for the National Museum. And I got some photographs of the bear too. That's quite a story also. But then in 36 and 37, I went those two summers. They gave me a ship, the brown bear, the Fish and Wildlife Service boat, and the captain and crew, and I went through the whole Aleutian chain in those two summers. And we landed on every island of the Aleutian chain. And to study the biology of those islands, the bird and animal life. And I was to recommend which island should be for birds and which should be for fox farming, because the native Aleuts were then turned loose of fox, the blue foxes on certain islands, and they let them just go breed for several years on the island, and then they'd go there and take the fox skins for their market. But I recommended that some islands be for birds only, but other islands be for fox farming, where they couldn't harm the birds so much. And then just lately, that's been published in my survey of the Alaska Peninsula and the Aleutian Islands and Kodiak Islands group has been published in the North American Fauna number 61. After all these years, just a couple of years ago, they published that. And I had an awful time to bring it up to date, because I couldn't quite either. But I was sent to elsewhere, to New Zealand and British Columbia and different places afterwards. So I got away from McKinley Park pretty well and began to go into other parts of the country. And so, well, that's just a part of the story, as far back as I can go, 1920 only.
This is Dr. Saul Urey and Mrs. Urey, a story of their life around Alaska from 1920 to today, and this was taken at the Tanana Yukon Historical Society, Village Park Recreation Hall, May the 25th, 1961. This is a written report of the Tanana Yukon Historical Society meeting held, its monthly meeting at the Recreation Hall of Birch Park Thursday evening with about 30 members and guests present. The meeting was conducted by President Audrey Loftus, who had been installed at the last meeting. All officers were present. Committees for the coming year were appointed, and several minor changes to the bylaws were discussed regarding dues, meeting dates, and so forth, and will be acted upon at the June meeting. Guest speakers were Dr. and Mrs. O-L-A-U-S M-U-R-I-E of Moose, Wyoming, and Mrs. M-U-R-I-E came to Fairbanks in 1911. She was the former Margaret Thomas, a very young girl, and her talk was reminiscence of life in Fairbanks and customs of that day from 1911 to 1918 when she went to the States for her college work. She returned later to attend the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines and was the first woman to graduate from the College of Alaska. She recalled the weekly horse-drawn sleighs that brought the mail from Valdez in winter and the excitement of the school children when they heard the sleigh bells and followed the sleigh to the post office. Another thrilling event was the first boat of the spring to come up the Chena River. When the whole town came down to the waterfront to meet it, Mr. Urey told of his experiences when he came to Alaska in 1920 for the Biological Survey to study caribou and other wildlife. During his first 5 years in Alaska, he traveled over many parts of the country, northward and westward, spending considerable time in McKinley Park, the Endicott Range, and the Great River areas. In 1936 to 39, his work took him on a complete survey of the animals and birds of Alaska Peninsula, Kodiak Island, and the Aleutian Chain. During these 3 summers, he had a U.S. Fish and Wildlife boat and crew, and they touched on almost every island in the area. Walking and traveling by dog team was the main means of travel in his mainland work. Living off the country and getting acquainted with the people of Alaska, Eskimos, Indians, and many white men who were living in the wilderness, trappers, traders, miners, and others, he recounted many interesting incidents and experiences. Two other visitors at this meeting were Lauren Stevens and Abbott Fenn from Philadelphia and Vermont, respectively. They were making quite a thorough tour of the state in preparation for planning to bring a group of boys to Alaska to make their 8-week tour of our great state. Refreshments were served, the meeting and the social visiting period was enjoyed by all present. The list of committees appointed: membership committee is Francis P. Baker, chairman, Ludwig Rinsky, James Hanlon, Theodore Loftus, and Dr. James Lindquist. The program committee was Florence Manville, chairman, Andrew Wicken, and Paul Griman. Tape recording is William Cashin, chairman, Ivor Scarlin, and Forbes Baker. Publicity is Harry Hughes and Mrs. Hertha Baker. Museum committee, catering and storing materials is Bruce Kelly, John Mueller, George Schmidt, and Otto Geist. Magazine committee is Charles Keim, chairman, Forbes Baker, Francis Baker, William Cashin, Adriana Coyle, Frederick Height West, Annabeth Henlon, Audrey Loftus, Franz Mansville, Earl Pilgrim, Victor J. Richardson, Ludwig J. Rowinsky, Ivor Scarlin, Andrew Wicken, Frank P. Young, and Robert Sheldon. The historical names committee are H.C. Torgerson, chairman, Esther Zimmerman, Hazel B. Thomas, James S. Couch, and Dennis Coyle. Picture identification will be Adriana Coyle, chairman, Frank P. Young, Ed B. Davis, Clyde Burkett, and Robert Sheldon. Refreshment committee is Alma Matlock, chairman, Annabelle Davis, and Dolly Young, and Shirley M. Johnson. That is the complete committee is appointed by the new president, Audrey Loftus. This is Harry Hughes recording this report on the tape.